of chemical engineering. Don't ask me what their goddamn law is, but it's a law. Because I often in Europe, they say, Bill, you mean Canadian Society of Chemical? Oh, I said, no. Anyway, I said that, no, I won't be attending. The reason is this, I'm not presenting a paper. If I had presented a paper, then my research fund, or my little company, I operate a little consulting company, could have paid for it. But if I don't present a paper, then I want to be honest and not travel. I wish more professors in Canada would follow this, my example.
Well, why don't we get started?
Yeah.
And I think everything is working on the tape recorder.
Oh, you have a tape recorder. Fine. Yeah. Now, the way to proceed, I don't want to ramble on. So you ask me the questions, if you don't mind.
Oh, yes.
And I'll answer the best way I can.
Sure. Yeah. All right. Well, let me begin by indicating that this is July 11th, 1991, and this is Jim Boning talking to Professor William Gauvin in Montreal. Dr. Gauvin, I know that you were born on March 30th, 1913 in Paris.
That's right, yes.
Could you tell me something about your parents and your family background?
Yeah, surely. That's an odd question, but I have nothing to hide. I was born in 1913 on the eve of the war, and there is a reason for my William, because my real first name was Guillaume. And like the name of Adolf or Benedict or whatever it is, Mussolini, my dad quickly changed my first name. He could make a radical change, but the equivalent of Guillaume in French is William. And that was accepted legally. My first name became William. The French, of course, not knowing any English or German or anything, didn't make the connection between Guillaume and Wilhelm, and so it has really been Bill, you see, or William. dad was at the time a wealthy Canadian, and he tried to escape. We didn't suffer too much during the war, except on one occasion when we were in a suburb of Paris. That was in 1917. And I remember I was a very little fellow when I saw those tall fellows dressed in green, very striking suits with a strange hat on them, and they were on horses. They were Uhlans. That doesn't mean anything to you, but that's that was the mounted cavalry, German cavalry, and they had reached. It was about 20 kilometers from Paris. Mm. And a captain in very good French picked me up in his arms and said, "Don't worry, little fellow, we're going to return it to you." And then disappeared. That was my one contact. But shortly after that, my dad, he had interest. He moved to London, a little place near London called Croydon. At the time, it was a small airport, still is actually a tiny airport. And I spent 3 or 4 years, and things quietened down, and we went back to Paris. And that's it. And I went to school in Croydon, where apparently I learned a smattering of English. At that age, you know, you pick up a language very quickly, which I promptly forgot when I went back to Paris. And after that, they decided to come to Canada, both of them, And at age 14, they left me with my grandmother was Belgian. Her name was Van Halle. And I met left with my grandfather, who was a man who made a great impression on me. He was a wonderful chess player, and also he was a terrific admirer of Napoleon. And he had, I don't know how he got copies of some of the campaign orders that Napoleon always prepared before a campaign, in which he ordered so many cannons and so many this, and book after book after book. He was quite a planner, let me tell you. And then I returned to Paris preparing for me. I wanted at that time to be an engineer, a chemical engineer. And
why did you want to be a chemical engineer? Where did that interest develop?
At school. It's interesting that you ask this question, because my life has been dictated by what I call turning points. One of them was when I attended a gymnasium, the equivalent, they call it in Belgium, in Brussels, Athénée Royal d'Ixelles. It's a secondary school after the German pattern, very tough course. I was in mathematics special, and at age of 14, we already had cleared up most of the elementary calculus, differential equations, and so on. Mm-hmm. And then we had completely unbalanced 15 hours of math every week, 1 hour of physics, 1 hour of chemistry, no lab, typical. But I was filled with math. I could, when I arrived in Canada, I could even teach mathematics at McGill. And then went back to Paris, and I was I was doing two things, preparing for the Grandes Écoles. I don't know if you're familiar with the French system.
No, I'm not.
It's very tough to enter École Centrale or Polytechnique or those things. The competition is horrendous. But I was a good student. And then disaster struck. That was 1929, the big crash. And I received a telegram from Canada to come back in a hurry. The fortunes of the family were so at age fortunately I was not quite 18, and I arrived, and it was a real disaster. My father was a poet, and always never worked, I just clipped coupons. And they had a number of companies, but I was a good businessman. I went over his portfolio, and there was one little company, an essential oil company. He owed only $50,000, the rest, it was hopeless. So I got them together, and I went to see it was really poverty, I'm not kidding. I went to see the bank manager with a lot of gall. I asked him for a loan, $50,000. He just laughed at me, and he says, "Look, you come back when you have prepared something." I did several times, and finally, 6 months later, I came with a proposal, and I walked out with $100,000 in credit. So we're cleared up our debt, and from then on, 3 years later, we all had our cars, and we were doing wonderful business. Mm. And then I wanted to go to university, but I had to wait until I had enough money, which was in 1936. And then I went back to McGill, but still kept an eye on the little company, which was a money maker. And the reason, now to answer your question, why I chose chemical engineering, rather, to be honest, engineering, because chemical engineering in those days, as you know, did not exist. Mm-hmm. It was called industrial chemistry. But what happened was that at Atelier Royal Dixon, we had a course which, strangely enough, had an English title, Self-Help. And there was a translation of an English book, which I've been trying desperately to obtain since then, which is simply a recital of the lives of famous people. The theme was always the same: terrible hardship, terrible poverty, illness, and so on, and finally triumph through hard work. And I said, my God, if those guys with all that could do it, I could do it. And I remember the life of Goethe affected me an awful lot. And the life of Blaise Pascal, who was half-blind, and all these things.
Do you remember the title of the book?
Yeah, Self-Help.
Self-Help.
And I've been trying to get a copy ever since. And I went several times to Atelier Royal Dixon, you know. I like to go on these memory trips, and I could never find a copy of it. But it was a bit of a turning point. But I certainly, at that time, I wanted to be an engineer. That there was no doubt about it. But it was many years before I could go to McGill.
Not a mathematician. You had all this mathematics.
Yes.
But
so I went to see the dean. And it was in those years, and a five-year course. And when I explained all the courses that I had taken in math, that's when he said, well, geez, you couldn't even teach these courses. So I entered directly in third year. And
that would have been 1936?
No, it was a little later. That was in... In 38.
38.
Sorry, in 38. And 3 years later, I got out with a degree of bachelor's of chemical... No. Yeah, chemical engineering. That's right. At the time, we had... by that time, things had evolved. And the head of the department, Jack Phillips, had been a student of Tom Sherwood. And he came
at
MIT.
Yes.
So Jack Phillips was really up to date, and I was very grateful for the training I got under him. So that I wanted to push on. The war was 41, and I tried to enlist, but I was prevented by the Canadian government. They wanted me to stay at McGill and do some advanced work on the synthesis and properties of RDX.
Yes.
I don't know if you heard about that damn thing that
yes.
the Italians had developed. It was disastrous to the Allies. But it was very easy to make. But we knew bugger all about the properties. So the whole... under supervision of a wonderful chemist called Dr. Carl Winkler. And he had 15 boys, all working on RDX. That was it. And I tried to work. I was so fed up with trying to measure viscosities and under all kinds of conditions and so on. He allowed me to make a second thesis. So I have two PhD theses, one on RDX, I think I have a copy, and the other one on electrochemistry. And he had the nerve to send my PhD thesis to Samuel Glasdow.
Oh, yes.
A giant. Who gave me an excellent, my God. So that explains why my first publications, there are about 10 or 12 of them, are all in electrochemistry.
Yes.
And, it was good training.
I wanted to back up for a little bit. I had one. The company that that you rescued from your father, what did that company do?
They were traders. We were buying flavor chemicals like vanillin, like coumarin.
Yes.
Also, an awful lot of dye stuff, which we got during the war, we got from Germany. You know, don't be surprised at this. The stuff, you know, you should have seen the cases when they arrived. They were covered, whatever. Usually they arrived through Portugal or Sweden. But they were German products. Germans needed the money, we needed the chemicals. I could tell you some stories, you know, about how a war stimulates business. And I always retained, except I shudder now because some of the dyes that we got, amaranth dye, the red, which is banned, the yellows were banned since then, the blues were really toxic, you know. We didn't know what the hell we were doing there, to be honest. And then by that time my dad was well launched, and the company was comfortable, not wealthy, but comfortable. So I decided to live my own. And I joined, as I told you, McGill. And I graduated with my PhD in 1945. And a classmate of mine was the son of Frank Horner. The steel in operation under the name of Frank W. Horner. And when we were at school, Frank died, and his son, the classmate Halden, became suddenly the president of a fair size, not as large as Merck or Ayers or anything like that, fair size. And he says, "Bill, I like you. I want you to come to work with me, but what I want you to do is develop chemicals. I don't want to mix vitamins like my dad does, a pound of this, a pound of that, coloring material, add sugar and stir, you see." He says, "I want to make real products." And it was a most colossal training that I ever got in my hair. He gave me a free hand, and we worked for the Department of Defense and developed new products. Defense, for example, wanted to dry, even after the war, they shipped an awful lot of blood plasma to the Canadian troops, which were, and the Allies, which are still on there. And they were shipping enormous quantities of water solutions with a minuscule amount of, let's say, blood plasma. So how could you dry this material, get the plasma out in a dry form, without altering, of course, its biological properties? And I developed, I can't say I invented, but I certainly one of the first to latch on to spray drying as a method of drying. And this was my lifelong interest. I've written quite a number of papers, mm-hmm, in the field, and I still do from time to time. And I got ill. We were working with pancreas glands from animals, and it's a wicked thing. And to make the story very brief, in that particular department, I allowed the people to work for only 3 hours a week, and even then they got all caught up dermatitis and so on. I seemed to be impervious. However, I didn't work, and I was in and out and in and out, and finally I got it, an abscess in the liver in the hospital. Then they died. And then when I was recovering, 3 months in the hospital, Jack Phillips comes to see me. "Bill," he says, "I need you. There's nobody in the Department of Chemical Engineering but me. I'm going nuts. You have taught chemical engineering throughout your master's and your PhD, and so I want you to come and work for me. And I did, and he gave me a hell of a big salary, an associate professor, $5,000, you know, a year in 1947 was a big salary indeed. And I got that salary for 1 year. And I went to see him. I said, look, if you allow me to go on developing my spray and selling my spray dryers, I was making a fortune for a milk industry and so on. Spray drying was still in its infancy, particularly as pictures of huge spray dryers, you know, that some of them were had an enormous capacity, but the characteristic of spray dryers is their enormous sizes, because of the volumes of drying air they use. And they, the smallest I ever built was about 30 feet high and 20 feet in diameter, and everybody admired those things. And he allowed me to do that, and no salary. Since then, I've taught at McGill continuously to this day. No, correction, to 62. And then I became, but I always maintain, and this is probably the only little characteristic things about my life, which is otherwise very plain and ordinary, is that I was always a member of McGill, never got a nickel, and lectured a colossal load until 1962. And then, but I was, during that time, I also had a job with the Pulp and Paper Research Institute, working on new processes and new techniques and patents and so on. It was next door to McGill, and I'm still working for them to this day. And then in 62, Miranda made me an offer, but I couldn't refuse. And I reluctantly told Felix that's the end of my lecturing days, but I would still conduct research. If it was, I had 12 graduate students, I couldn't dump them. Miranda kicked like a mule and said something about lack of allegiance, and they don't believe in somebody. And I told them, for Christ's sake, this is all the things that I'm doing are of use to you, but it's up to you to use them. And that's all. And about it, and I always had a big gang of chemical engineers, never less than 8 graduate students, mostly PhDs. But I had one thing that is not apparent. I had an immense amount of energy, and I loved that research. And at Miranda, very often I found the work I was just pedestrian, working on goddamn copper and zinc and moly, and I learned a lot. We developed the new processes, but they were terribly reluctant to adopt radically new technology. They still are, incidentally, I'm sorry to say. And that's it, and that explains my relationship with McGill, which lasts to this day, except now I told them that I realize that all of this granted work is for the birds when you have an idea, because you develop new processes, their success, the thesis gets an excerpt, it gets published, and of course everybody has access to do it. And so I realized that I was, as I said, spinning my wheels.
Could I go back to your undergraduate days at McGill? Could you tell me a little more about what the curriculum was like, what kind of courses you took?
Well, I was given credit for all the courses in math, and strangely enough in physics and chemistry. But I've never taken descriptive geography, for example. And I'm sorry, I sort of evaded that thing. But they were Jack Phillips gave a splendid course. It was a static course. He never changed one goddamn word from year to year. And I took his courses and I admired him as a professor. He put in a lot of energy in his courses. And it was, I must admit, in those days, the latest. And Tom Sherwood and Stuart Churchill will. I got a splendid undergraduate training, to his eternal credit. But then later on, when he allowed me to take over some of his lectures, I put in new stuff in it, you see, and I kept up with the literature, mm-hmm. and also I benefited an awful lot from my graduate students. We were breaking ground, you know. None of the trivial things of measuring the viscosity of water to the tenth decimal, none of this crap. All industrial processes, new processes. And slowly I got involved in higher and higher temperature. The AST, for example, the mass suspension technique, I was limited by the resistance of the walls, the metallic walls. I couldn't exceed 1,000 degrees centigrade. Temperature was too low, the reactors were too large, and then I happened to read about plasmas, and that was it. That changed my life completely.
Yes.
Completely, radically, because then I could put a fantastic heat source right into the medium, you see, and effect. And I've written quite maybe 50 papers on at least 40 anyway, if you want to.
When you were an undergraduate, were there other faculty besides Phillips in the chemical engineering department?
Yes. First there was Ken Shelstad, who gave me a hand. Then one of my wonderful graduate students by the name of T.W. Hoffman, and I got him to teach courses. He was an older guy, and he was working on a very tough problem of radiations, and I got into hot fights with Hottel at MIT.
Yes.
Who was, and still is, very static. He's terrific on furnaces, but he wasn't completely in the current of radiation I was using him with, you know. And he didn't like my young squirt of the gopher correcting him or something like that, and we have never had a hot relation since then. And then Murray came on the scene, I think in the late 50s, I believe. I'm not quite clear about the time. And he was a wonderful teacher, and we formed a profound friendship to this day. He's taking a sabbatical in France. He loves France, and he manages to come back every 3 months, because he has also, I think, 8 or 9 graduate students, and he always stays with me at my home. And so this is a kind of friendship. Mm-hmm. And I found also wonderful friendship with the past students. Typical, for example, we do that probably every 10 years. And we, a gang of them, invited me to come to New York about a month ago. And we spent a riotous 3 days in New York City. There were about 12 of them. Well, I'm rambling, but because you
Thank you.
Oh, yes. No, I'm quite interested in this.
I'm trying to shut... but there have been turning points in throughout my life. The spray drying discovery was completely changed my life around. It enabled me, geez, at one time, as a young man, I was pulling $50,000 and $100,000 a year selling those spray dryers. And that made me very independent, and that's important.
How did that develop? How did you get into that in the first place? And what was the key
well,
there?
Well, that was this. it was for the department. I don't think that should go in the record, how it came, because it was the work was highly secret. It was carried out for the Ministry of Defense. But after that, they told me, all right, don't mention our name ever, but what you have developed, you can patent. There I was wise enough not to patent. I was consulting for Bourne Engineering and also... but I never patented this, but the milk industry knew about me, and they were not about to tell them that the milk was spray dried or anything like that. Industry, particularly in Canada, and even the States, it's a closed shop, you see. But that was one turning point due to this absolutely unexpected project that I was asked to carry out. Another turning point was one day, that was during the early 50s. A friend of mine who had obtained a PhD was a chemist at the same time. We had lunch together at a faculty club.
That cigarette is backwards, by the way.
Thank you. Would you like one?
No, I'm fine.
You're not buying much more?
No, not at all.
We were having lunch at a faculty club. He says, Bill, I have a terrible problem. I've been asked, I'm working for the Pulp and Paper Research Institute. He says, I'm a research associate there. And they asked me to fluidize bark and extra find what kind of organic chemicals you can get from the treatment of bark at high temperature. I said, you're nuts. You cannot fluidize bark. Bark is full of little fibers and all that. But he says, I think I know how to do it. And I'll come back to the lab with you this afternoon, and we'll have, do you have, for safety reasons, do you have in your lab a bucket full of sand? Says every lab has a bucket full of sand. Said, okay, put sand in the in your reactor. And we fluidize your goddamn bark. And it was going. We were evolving a lot of crap, but that was his business. He wanted to at this moment, about 4 o'clock, in walks a tall, handsome man. Hello, gentlemen, what are you doing? And Alan got up on his feet immediately and almost saluted. And he says, Dr. Fismeyer, I want you to meet a good friend of mine. He's giving me a hand. His name is Bill Gora. He's attached to the Department of Chemical Engineering. Oh, he says, hello, Bill. He says, my name is Fizz. That was his nickname. And he says, you know, the problems of pulp and paper industry? I said, no. What's the problem? We're shortage of sulfur. And it was true. You're too young to remember those days. But in Canada, no sulfur, no pulp and paper. And is there any way of recovering sulfur from the spent liquors received? I said, no, but I could take a crack at it. So anyway, we talked friendly and said, let's have a drink. We had a drink. Let's have dinner. We had dinner. Come back to my house. I went back to his office. He was a heavy drinker, and I don't mind having a drink. At 12 o'clock, I walked out. I had a job, and a damn good one, in the Pulp and Paper Research Institute, which is next door. It was ideal, at a good salary. This time I accepted a salary, no BS. And I've been, 2 years later, I became head of his chemical engineering division, which was small, mind you. There were never more than 20 of them. And we worked like hell, and we recovered the sulfur. But by that time, sulfur was plentiful. So my raison d'être initial disappeared. But in the meantime, I had developed a new technique of treating waste pulp liquors called AST, atomized suspension technique, which we patented. That one we patented. And that was a huge success. That was simply contacting a spray, spray drying, mm-hmm. That's it. I always, capitalize on my little baggage. And that was promptly taken up by the industry. And I was ahead of his chemical engineering division until 1962, at which time, as I told you before, I latched on to the Noranda people, because I visualized that I was developing a lot of interesting processes. Few of them applied to the pulp and paper, and Fesmeyer was on the fire, and I knew this indirectly, and he couldn't continue to support my work, and by that time I got $1 million. It was a good sum in those days. So we kissed goodbye, and shortly after I left, strangely enough, he had made some enemies. He drank too much, and he had built this huge lab. It's amazing. That is on St. John Road. It's within, you could see it if you had your room facing there. And he built that lab in 1956, but I stayed downtown. It was a beautiful lab, and that's to his credit. Then he was replaced by another friend of mine, incidentally. But by that time, I felt that Noranda offered a better future. It was a big company, and we dickered a heck of a lot because they didn't want me to go on with my McGill. I said, I'd never leave McGill, I'll never leave Dickett or leave it. So they left it. But they came back a few months later. In the meantime, I got a partner. They wanted to get in the pulp and paper industry all of a sudden, using my knowledge of the industry. So I tried, for a moment, for a brief period, I crossed the ocean 2-3 times a month, because mistakenly I thought the British would be a good partners, but they were afraid to invest in Canada. So finally, in desperation, I said, to hell with the British. Let's go with the Americans, which I did, and I made a few phone calls. Meat Corporation accepted, and they had the guts to build, in those days, 1,000 ton a day craft mill in Prince George, which is in operation to this day. 1,000 tons a day now is not exactly small potatoes, but it's not the biggest in the world. But at the time it was. So they're still partnered with Mead, and Mead is still using my AST, so sometimes I get a call and I whip over and correct things, and that's. I had a lot of fun in my life, you know. I could have made a lot of money if I had patented, and even now I could have developed lately some processes which I carefully didn't patent. and well, to complete, so that was the third turning point. The second turning point was the appearance of Fischmeyer on the scene, completely unexpected. That, my friend, is a turning point. And very quickly, he was a decisive. This is, that guy is we were very similar, energetic and lots of pep. Mm-hmm. Now all you see is a shell, you see, but in those days, my dear fellow, he gave me what I needed, the freedom and the funds and so on. No, rather didn't. They tried me to keep me on a tight leash, but I felt I was getting older, and it was 50 when I made this change. I said, Bill, let's smarten up, let's stay put. It turned out to be a good company. I made a good salary. When I was 65, 1 month I was all ready, and I formed a company, all ready to move. And I got a call from the chairman, who was president, Al Paulus, a very good friend. He says, Bill, we can't find a replacement for you. Will you work for us another 5 years? No, he said 3 years. No way, 3 years. At 68, I'll be completely out of touch. 5 years. And I said, what's the incentive? $10,000 more a year. I said, that does it. So I stayed with them. And then when I left them, my small company was in operation, and then I got a big contract on with Hydro-Québec, because I had sold my patent for that. I got the dollar for all my patents on plasmas, and I sold them personally for $950,000. I wanted $1 million, and I would have accepted $50,000. But the guy says, Bill, you're a heart, and I offer you $900,000. The damn fool. And we set up for $950. But then I was hired to promote the development of plasma for Hydro-Québec. But they didn't want to let me, to give me a free hand the way I wanted to do it. I was working for a guy there who was really a hard nut. And finally, but I had my PhD students, but this time in the Hydro-Québec lab, which is a wonderful lab, except I had...
That's here in Montreal.
That's in the suburbs. That's 50 miles, not quite, from my home. So there I was every morning, leaving in a horrendous traffic, coming back at night, and I killed myself. But then finally, at the end of 1989, sorry, I got fed up and I resigned. And since then, I'm semi-retired, but very active for McGill. I'm on the board of governors. I'm on the investment committee, which I love. The pension funds, which I love less, certain promotional groups and so on, various committees, and still on the board of governors, and that's it. That's the story of my life.
What changes have you seen in McGill from the time you first arrived? How would you characterize McGill when you arrived, and how would you characterize it today?
It is overburdened by administration. The desire of the principal to please everybody, and so as a result, it's very slow in making decisions. Reluctance to cut down on the... McGill is in a hell of a financial situation. Our debt is now about $70 million accumulated over the... You see, McGill gets most of its funds from Quebec, which gets its funds from the federal, and Quebec insists on allocating these federal funds and do the to the various universities, and they have been very tough. To be honest with you, very tough from the beginning. It is now being being corrected. So I think this year, for the first time, we'll close our budget after an awful lot of soul searching, and that caused David Johnston to engage in a monumental program of soul searching. Priorities, you should see the priorities, it's ridiculous how they go into unbelievable details and details and so on, and it's not an exactly dynamic university, but they're fortunate. They have a big deal, they have a high rating. I don't know if you're aware of the Gorman assessment. Gorman is a guy who has taken upon himself to rate universities in throughout the world, the Western world, and we come very high in chemical engineering. We're number two or number three. I forget who has Stanford, I believe, is number one. We are ahead of MIT, actually. So we're very high, rated very high. But it's not very efficient. David, he's so anxious to please everybody, God damn it. And, how many times when I raise my hand at board meetings, yes, he says, Bill, and what have you got to say again? Yes. So I really have to use my judgment after all.
Let me go back again to your early days at McGill. You ran into Winkler through this RDX
That's
program.
Right. Because we didn't have, at the time when I started this working in 41, I was the only guy teaching any chemical engineering at McGill, and I wanted to, and then I was forced by the government to work on RDX. And for Winkler, he turned out to be a close friend of mine. And then I got a master of chemical engineering. It was just a paper thesis, but I got a master's degree in it. And then I wanted to get a PhD in chemical engineering, but I couldn't. It was not allowed by the Department of Chemistry. A one-man department could not have a graduate program at the doctorate's level. So I turned around the difficulty, and my own degree, my PhD, is not in chemical engineering. It's in physical chemistry. I don't know if you noticed that.
Yes, I did notice that. Yeah. That's what I was getting to. I wanted to ask you about that.
And then by that time, Phillips came back from London. He had a very important job in London. He was the coordinator of sulfuric acid production for the Allies. That's a tremendous job. And he came back. He was also very energetic, tremendous. And then the two of us were saying, we've got to have a productive program. So we insisted and insisted, and finally at first all my students were master students. They had to be, there was no PhD. But I think around the middle 50s
I think 54, I read some.
54 is my first PhD?
Yes.
Yeah. Mm-hmm. That's it, that's fair.
Could you tell me some more about Winkler? What kind of a person was he to work for?
Well, I should tell you that as an example of the nature of the guy, I was profoundly fed up with my work on RDX. And to the point that when I got my master's degree in 42, and Winkler assigned me, I had to, there's no turning around. I hated it. And I started to drink and fool around, and sometimes it went weeks before I even reported to my lab. He didn't say anything. But he gave me the silent treatment, and I felt worse and worse and worse. So one day, I came out to see him. Doc, can I show you some curves that I obtained? He said, did you do some experimental work in this report? But that went right through my heart. And I couldn't make head or tail of that goddamn curve. And he was an analyst. He said, that's an excellent piece of work. I said, what the hell are you talking about? Look at the scatter. Forget about the goddamn scatter. He says, look at this curve. He says, now you have to refine the data. But I'm very pleased with this. Keep it up. And that was it. From here on out, I started working like a dog. And then I asked him permission. I said, for God's sake, I'll go out on the RDX. Let me do something else. Well, he says, I'm very interested in electrochemical deposition of copper, strangely enough. And that played a role with Nareda eventually. And he says, I'd like you to, on the QT, start a project on the effect of addition agents on the properties of the metallic deposit that you get. And this was my first 10 papers were on that.
Now there was an industrial relationship there too, wasn't there? I mean, was he consulting with companies?
Yes, he was consulting for Inco.
Okay.
And I got a scholarship from Inco in addition to this IDX work. And he insisted. Inco was a strange company. I could never get them interested in my work. So Winkler, I was there in his office, he got mad when they called the vice principal. I'm coming to see you next week with my student, Bill Gover. And he said, we want to show you our results, which are very interesting. And interesting. And reluctantly, the guy accepted us. And he kept us there, he got interested. And from then on, we got his attention. Because they were also depositing copper, but not at the same level as Canadian copper refineries. It were big refineries that belonged to Miranda. So I went to see Canadian copper refineries. All my life I was mixed up with Miranda, with Inco, and so on. It was fun.
So you did this electrochemical work on the side while you were doing the RDX work.
Yes, that's exactly it.
That must, well, you said you had the energy. It must have required a lot of time.
Yeah, 12 hours a day and weekends and things like that. But when I was interested, then it was interesting work. We were breaking ground, you see.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah. One for the... And I'm not bragging, you know, actually... I'm telling you, I'm answering your questions.
No, that's fine. Well, you had a paper, let's see, you said the first 10 papers were mostly electrochemical with Winkler.
Yeah.
But then you did have, by 1955, you had a paper on spray drying.
Mm-hmm.
And
yes.
So you were moving in that area already.
That's right,
too.
Yeah. By then, I, well, to be honest with you, I was designing those, it's rather amusing. All the spray dryers in existence at the time which I had designed were either identically the same size as the ones that I had developed for Frank W. Horner on blood plasma drying, or a multiple thereof, doubling everything, but not altering the relationship of the important parameters. In other words, I didn't know what the hell I was doing, but I was doing something right, you see. And then I said, this has got to stop. And this is when I started this whole series of papers on spray drying, but much further, this is where I started to work on particles, the motion of particles. Yes. And I had endless papers on that, which was a fascinating field. And finally we knew what we were doing.
Well, I recall one paper that you had where you used, you did some radioactive tracer work to try and trace the...
With lead turbine, yes.
To try and follow the particles.
That's right, yes. That was a clever piece of work. And actually, Len Torabin, who was a guy who did that particular work with me, was at that New York party. I shook hands with him, and I found, shaking his hand, that he still had the scars. That guy, he was so anxious to get a hot particle, we had it irradiated at Chalk River, and we got this in what we call a castle, all lead. And he was so anxious to get the goddamn particle out of the castle into this enormous wind tunnel we had, did it with his hands. A foolish thing to do, but I said, Len, what are you doing, for Christ's sake? These particles are, to this day, he has the scars, but he's being followed and there is no danger at all.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah. Yeah, that's right. I'm not proud of that at all, because but I never had any accident, but it was a very, very effective way of measuring the velocity of particles under all kinds of conditions, all kinds of shapes, all kinds of acceleration, deceleration, and so on. And the work went on with fellows like the oscillation of, we certainly knew our particle dynamics.
Mm-hmm.
Stuart Churchill was very interested in this. And he became a very good friend. And then the oscillatory motion and so on, yeah. That's one thing to my small credit, and although I'm an industrial engineer, and all my projects, every damn one of them, had an ulterior industrial eventual application. But I felt the necessity to this day of knowing what the hell you're doing from a fundamental point of view. And that has paid off handsomely.
Mm-hmm. Well, certainly your mathematics background paid off there.
Sure, you bet.
And then you started using, I was trying to figure out when you started using computers. Because there was one paper when I noticed you were using a IBM 650 or something
like
that.
Yes, that's all we had at McGill. And then there was a fellow, Sayeg, who did a magnificent piece of work on a very high temperature heat transfer to spheres. And we had worked out all the mass of 650, who was getting rid of a sort of desperation I called a Hamilek, a good friend of mine at in Hamilton at McMaster University, and they had a high, for these days, a high power, and even then we kept that damn thing running for hours at a time, but we solved all our equations. And since that time, every one of our students have their own computers, and they use them profusely. I'm lousy on computers. And I can't get the reason is that at Noranda, you see, I had an army of guys working for me. And if I had a program, a computer program, and I knew what I wanted, I said, okay, you figure out the program, and you, we had all the computer facilities, and they did the work. So I consider computers a little bit like plumbing. And we have plumbers, and we have draftsmen, and we have computer guys. I declare this now, because now that I have time, I'm going to go back and do a more thorough study. What the devil did you accumulate on all this?
Oh, these are... I have some more things yet.
Oh.
Most of it is just following through the papers that you wrote and piecing that together.
Because I had, I had some, but it's probably not necessary. I have a write-ups, a few write-ups. There is one in Canadian Chemical News for March of this, which presents a summary of my career.
Oh, yes.
I brought that along.
Is that an extra copy?
No, that is original that I cut off and see. But you said it, mail it back to me.
Oh, yes. Yes.
It starts out here. William Grover, of course, you have to read it with a grain of salt, but the substance is there. Researcher, teacher, and manager. Well, that's true. And this.
All right, fine.
Yeah. I also brought a copy of my CV in case. Did you receive
yes.
it?
Yes, yes. Oh,
okay.
We did get that.
Yeah.
Yes.
And there was a lot of. I got a prize in 1984. But it's in French. But it's a very good summary of my career. There I am, visiting the mines, because I became a mining engineer. That's me, and some of my students are there. Because naturally, you won't be surprised to learn that most of the staff on the radar was filled with Gomez's boys.
Well, I'd like to make a copy of this, if I could.
And this is at the opening of the Miranda Research Center. There I am. There is Madame Guérin, who was a minister of some sort. And this was a premier of the province, René Lévesque. You probably have heard about that character.
Yes.
Yeah. It's a book. It's well done. It's La Passion de Science, a passion of science, but it's in French. It's portraits of various people who got the prize. It's the big prize of Quebec But the prize that I most cherish is the Kellum Prize in Engineering. You wouldn't know about that in the States, but you might be. It carries $50,000, so it gives you an idea. You're an American, you're like me. You're African. This was only 25. You see.
Would it be possible to borrow this to photocopy? I might be able to do that downstairs before you leave.
And then, okay.
And then,
okay.
So
yes.
I want to take it with me.
Yeah, that's right. But it is in French.
Yeah. I also brought the program, which I did send you, I think it's a program, of the Lamotte lecture.
Oh, yes, I think I have.
And you will recognize the... L.B. Torbin is there, my key man, and also our luncheon, Stuart Churchill was a dinner speaker. You know Stuart, eh?
Yes.
I respect him immensely,
yes.
You know. And there are also a few, there was Julian Zicali at MIT, he was one of our speakers. Ed Crosby, University of Wisconsin, and Bob Marshall was dead. He was also a close friend. Crosby is a very good spray dryer man. So there's some important. Pierre Fauché was a president of University of Limoges, and Emil Fender, you may or may not know, in the University of Minnesota.
Could I? That list. I don't have that list that was in that program.
No.
No,
no, all I have is... You see, what you may not know is that this was a preamble,
mm-hmm.
But the meat of the whole thing is that a day and a half, you see. I was very pleased to get this.
Yes, I just have a copy of the first part, but I would like this as well.
Well, I didn't want to slow you.
No, that's...
Here. I don't know what. When you ask me, now I've been doing a lot of talking, but what is the purpose of all this?
The purpose of all of this is, as we've done with Stuart Churchill, is to create a document for future use, to outline your career in such a way that other people might use some of this information in the future for scholarly purposes. It's an archival project.
Yeah, but I'm not a Stuart Churchill man. Let's be very honest about this. In Canada, I'm fairly well known.
Exactly.
But Stuart Churchill, in his ways, he's a giant, you know. And I don't compare with that kind of guys. Anyway.
I have talked to Hoy Hoddle, by the way, too, a number of years ago.
Yeah. And what did he say? Shut me down.
No. He didn't talk about you at all.
Oh, I see. Hoddle also was damn good in his days. And then he got stuck with his combustion furnaces and all that. And I don't think he did it the right way. He didn't go after the fundamentals enough.
See, who else have we talked to? Donald Katz.
Oh, yeah, Jesus. Yes.
I just talked to Neil Amundsen last year.
Neil who?
Amundsen. He was at Wisconsin.
Yeah. Another giant, for gosh sake. You know. Yes.
And Manson Benedict, who was nuclear engineering at MIT. He's a physical chemist, actually.
Mm-hmm.
Well, let me ask you a few more questions, if I may.
Sure.
Can we go back to Horner again? I was quite intrigued by that time period.
That's right.
That's the work
of the war.
Yes, the work that you were doing there.
Mm-hmm.
So in your spray drying technique, I mean, you really developed spray drying through that association.
Absolutely. I have photos, actually, of the spray dryer that I designed for them. Those were very formative.
Who built these
spray dryers? Very formative years.
Who built these spray dryers? I mean, they were large, as you said, they were large.
Oh, enormous. It's all, it's a simplicity itself. It's simply tinsmith kind of work.
Okay.
Mind you, the large size, the walls have got to be sturdy. And even the first time we tried it, you could see the volume of gas was so large, and the walls were so thin that you could actually see the damn thing expanding about an inch, you know, which frightened us no end. I had miscalculated the resistance of materials. What we were attempting to do is make amino acids, which were in great shortage and a very important medical component. There are a number of very important ones, and they were unobtainable. So typically, Haddon one day says, "Bill, next project." That was before a spray dryer. "I want you to develop a method of making amino acids." I said, "Okay, Haddon, that's it." So I got my boys together, and we found that by taking casein and treating it with the best what we found was animal pancreas glands. And to the point, you know, pancreas glands are used to this day to make insulin. And we cornered the pancreas gland market in Canada, so is it the Fleming Institute? And
could be, because Fleming just
cannot in Toronto threatened to sue because we were cornering the markets, and to us money was no question, so we doubled it. But those glands are absolutely wicked. They would dissolve all the, well, that's exactly what they do, you know, what you, they chew the, and as a result of this, there is an enormous, well, a large fraction, which is change into, to change proteins into the, there's a chain of reactions and so on, ending up with the amino acid that we wanted. Yeah, I've forgotten the sequence of it's organic chemistry, which is well known now. So that was one project, and he refused to become just a manufacturer of colored water pharmaceuticals. And we were interested in making cholesterol, of all things, out of spinal, spinal cords. Mm. Because cholesterol has a medical function as well. Yeah. Oh, geez, I learned so much. And the free hand that I had and the money and so on, it was wonderful.
Well, you have over the years been involved with and talked about science policy and government here in Canada.
Mm-hmm.
Maybe we should talk about that a little bit, because I was intrigued by that. You've commented that here you had money and a free hand, but later on your associations, you didn't have that free hand. And do you think that stifles creativity when you're...
Yes, absolutely. You need a certain amount of freedom, but my dear fellow, it must be oriented freedom. Mm-hmm. You cannot allow, before we embarked on anything, we did an awful lot of preparation. And what I deplored all the time, I didn't know you were interested in that aspect, because it's quite a story. I've become really obsessed with the idea of additional government support for R&D. And I published a paper which I think the contributions of R&D to economic growth.
Mm-hmm.
And in there, it was, unfortunately, it was published in Chemistry Canada, a paper with very limited distribution. But that is, it's a little, and I took one of our companies, we didn't name which one, at Miranda. And the contribution that accrued to the government from, I took the hypothetical case. I didn't want to, was not allowed to mention the company. And we analyzed what a certain amount of research, assuming that it hit the, we were by that time at Miranda with the principle that I put in for out of, let's say that we had 500 ideas from all sources, everybody, technicians and everything. Some of them were shut down immediately because some were in aluminum, Christ were not in aluminum, so that was out, or some. And finally we shut to about 100, but we looked at a little more closely. Got my crew together, we got that down to about 20. At out of the 20, we began to do a little bit of experimental work. It's all right, you know, to do things on paper. And we then we retained out of these 505. These are big projects. And by big projects, something $500,000. We put in, we felt that there's something. And sure enough, out of those five, four bit the dust. Mm. Not because of the technology, but because of the economics. The economics were and are my big enemy. But the one winner that we had made up for the whole goddamn program. That was my thesis. And then I took a hypothetical case and how much would return to the company. And of course, I had all the figures, eh, salaries and so on. And how much would go to the government? And I was astounded to see that the government, out of this, the amount that invested in research, with their assistance, the return that they got from all sources. Perhaps you might be, but it's tough reading because. I don't know if you'd be interested to go to wade through all this this material, but I got very, very interested in this.
What kind of a response did you get to that paper?
Very good from a limited number. To this day, I received. It was published held in 72 or 82 or something like
81.
That. 81. 81. Mm-hmm. But it was a lousy paper to publish it in, but I felt duty-bound to, after all, I don't know if I was president or something like that for the Canadian Institute, the Institute of Chemical Institute of Canada. But I could let you have a copy. I've got a copy at home.
Yes, I'd like to have a copy. Yeah. During that 70 time period.
Oh, and then as a result of this, I initiated this concept of what we call action concertée. And this is not part, you won't see it, concerted action, in which we got industry, university, and government together to concert and work on a number of projects of interest, and we developed that and the techniques to do that. And, those were glorious years, but again, it's it went down like many good ideas.
Well, you had a number of, in addition to the one paper we've just mentioned, you had papers such as Chemists and Science Policy, National Planning for Innovation.
Yeah.
Were you involved with the government directly, or was this your effort on...
That is one thing that is not apparent from my curriculum vitae, and I underplayed it. I wonder what the hell... the National Research Council one day, National Research Council of Canada, mm-hmm. called Paris Rabas and oh my God, but there it was an important year in the air. The there. Well, at least I don't see it. Well, anyway, briefly, I think it's the was in the early 80s, Paris received a call from, in those days, Bill Schneider was the president of the National Research. I knew him well, and through McGill, through the, and he was very much aware of my interest in this concerted action of, and he called Paris. He didn't let me know, and Paris gave me a call one day. He says, "Bill," he says, "I got a call from Bill Schneider. He's under fire for the on the part of the government, because it's a government agency, and a big one, you know, 4,000 people, to have industrial applications orientation." And he asked me if, Paul speaking, if I could loan you to the council for a period of a year or two to become a head the planning function for the Research Council. And you'll have the title of Delegate General. Now, as a Frenchman, I knew immediately what he meant. But to a lot of people who came to see me, said, "What the hell is a Delegate General?" So when I left, finally, the council said, "The first thing you're going to do is cancel that stupid, do away with that stupid title." But anyway, it was a tough job, because Paris, having said that, "I'll give you all the facilities and all the time, and you can, providing you could spend half of your time in Ottawa," which I did religiously, at a grand office, all the assistants. It was a tough job, talking to all these directors of divisions and so on, and slowly, slowly, not losing my temper, which was tough, and I think I contributed a great deal to. At first, they thought I was going to be, because of the powers I had, I was going to be a hatchet man. And I visited all the goddamn divisions and so on, and talked to all the guys. I entertained a lot. And I think I made some changes, which are probably coming to roost now, but they started at the time to impress me with the necessity. Do fundamental work like I have. I'm the example. But try to orient them, for Christ's sake, towards it. Eventually, or point out their industrial... So I insisted that in all the program, on certain projects, not all of them, they indicate the relation of this fundamental work to and the industrial implications of the program. And they insisted that this be done. So. And, they were convinced, and they did. And I did that for a year and a half. It damn near killed me. Because I remember sometimes going to Ottawa twice the same day, leaving Montreal. It's only an hour and a half, and all that good cars. For example, leaving the house about 7 o'clock for an 8:30 meeting with the president, whipping back at around 11 o'clock for a luncheon appointment with some of my group, whipping back for a 3 o'clock meeting at the NRC, coming back home limping for my supper. I didn't do that often, but I did it on a number. But I had wonderful assistance from all my people at Miranda. They knew what I was trying to do, and they were proud of the fact, and that the boss that was always, and I was trying desperately to set examples. I strongly believe in motivating your people. That's the key to success. Yes. in research, you know.
Yes.
So that's what I try to do in a very, very small way. It's strange that it's not on my curriculum vitae. Probably I thought it was not important enough.
You also had a paper called Northward Looking, Strategy and Science Policy for Northern Development.
Oh, yeah. Oh, geez. At that time I was a member of the Science Council of Canada. And... actually, I spent. I was re-elected for another job for another 3 years, and then the president of the Science Council said, "Bill, you're going to head a team. We won't give you the funds, and you're going to crisscross the north, talk to the people, and see what the freehand, see what the hell do you can do with these." Inuits, Inu this, and Métis, and so on. And I did for 3 weeks, whole gang of us. We covered the north. Mm. I must say, however, it was in the late summer, so I can't tell you a glorious story about the midnight. We were working on too much daylight. couldn't go to sleep. Thick report on this, which of course nobody, and still the north, our north is in a sad state of development. But I did, and the report is available from the Science Council.
What was your major result from that report, though? What did you recommend?
Well, I recommend that start cottage industries, and there were a few in operation. But I should tell you that I was brainwashed by Finland. I presented a paper in Helsinki And then, because of this assignment for the Science Council, I insisted that I spend a week in Lapland, and then I saw how the Laps were at just about the same latitude, you know, as the our own north, and how they were, for example, canning caribou meat, doing their own canning, which was a very simple operation after heat treatment, which sold that in Helsinki, I don't know, $5 a pound. It was a delicacy. And whereas the north, they kill the caribou and leave most of the carcasses. They had beads, bead industry, and everything they were giving. It was an example how people with initiative can really function under extreme northern conditions, and if they're proud, make a living out of it, stand on their own. And there's something about if you ever have a chance to visit Lapland, it would be a really an eye opener. The way they stand, it's the way they're dressed, you know, and so on. The way they treat the caribou skins and so on, and the ornaments that they have. And I try to get the people to inject some pride and some design, and so it didn't work. Temporarily, and it was a strange phenomenon, which I certainly I wouldn't want to repeat. In all the localities we were visiting, I always had some RCMP, Royal Canadian Mounted Police people with me. It insisted on attending council meetings, because everything in the tribal system, you've got to understand the tribal system, everything depends on getting a council and so on. And usually at those council, when I arrived, I found a few people there, whites, standing by, Americans, I must say, and there were counselors. And I told my RCMP, get these guys out. I want to have a frank discussion and not anything influenced by the presence of this so-called counselors, you see. And I don't think those counselors were very effective. What they were trying to do, I don't know. But it was, they were not effective. And if anything, they were detrimental. I tried to get friendly with some of them, and they always came out with grandiose explanations that they want to have the native rights respected, which I agree with, and so on, that we are abusing, and that the waste is only temporary, because for example, if you go to Arctic Bay, which is one of the loveliest location in the high north, it's north of Baffin Island, and what do you see on you see two things in the north: miles and miles of empty drums, oil drums. They depend on oil, you see, shipped at a cost, I leave it to you. And also dozens and dozens of snowmobiles, which are left abandoned, sometimes for ridiculous reason, spark plugs, they didn't know how to replace them, or batteries or things like that. The waste was abhorrent to me, you see. So I was preaching and preaching. The situation hasn't changed much. Our north is a very sorry state.
And of course, those guys are forever complaining, and they're well supported, you know, by the government. The nurses, the doctors, and this and that, the schools. And he said, genetic, it's a huge problem. Anyway, I'd rather not talk about it.
Okay.
I don't think I was effective. I wrote a blistering report, and, which should be available, actually, if you were interested in it. But but that's it, the development of the cottage industry.
I have, on one occasion, been at James Bay.
Oh, yes.
And once at the Iron Ore Company of Canada in Labrador.
Yeah,
not that as far north as you're talking, but that's as far north as I've been in Canada.
Yeah, sure.
But some, I could identify with some of that with James Bay.
Yeah, I see. Did you visit some native villages?
Yes, we were out in the where the government had actually built houses for them, and where they had taken the doors and the windows out.
Yeah.
And then we were talking to a Catholic priest who talked about how they would take snowmobiles in the dead of winter and go north.
Yeah.
Survive as their ancestors had.
Yes, I do.
Then there was a British part of the of that area where they had the hospital. And,
yeah.
And, so it was an interesting experience.
Yeah. And it's not unique, you know. I met it. I did an awful lot of traveling for Lorena. I traveled a third of my time, mostly in Africa, some of it in Iran, and quite a bit in Turkey. Always in connection with the development of properties, copper deposits and things like that, and what had to be done. That was the first wave, and if we made any dent in the possibility of an agreement, then there was a second wave, and those were the money boys, and I was left in the background, you see. But, but that was their technique, to send a delegation ostensibly for scientific purposes, but have feelers with what could be developed. And sometimes we did, sometimes we didn't. Sometimes it was impossible. You have to understand in most of these countries the importance of a tribal importance. South Africa and not so much in Zambia, but in Zaire particularly. Anyway.
How did you make that connection with Naranda? How did that come about?
They came to me.
They came to you?
Yeah. I don't know where I got my name, and they approached me, yes. Yeah. Very arrogant and so on. As a matter of fact, I remember once the president was Jack Bradfield. Again, that's not for the record, for Christ's sake. We were having dinner in Toronto, and I said, Jack, we were talking research and the importance of research, and I was talking, I had a feeling I was talking into deaf ears. I said, well, Jack, why do you want to create an R&D facility for Naranda? Well, he says, you know, we're a big company. They were not that big, no, but they are now. They're a 10 billion company, so nothing to sneeze at. I think I would say largely for prestige. It was dessert time. I said, Jack, I think that completes our conversation for today. I'm afraid I've got to catch with it. And then I didn't answer his phone calls. That was it. I wasn't going to work for prestige, for God's sake. But that's not my point of view. It's really And now you can, it's 2 minutes from here, you see that research center now. And they've, again, when I was there, I doubled the size, and now they doubled it again. It's a monster now. It's, well, relatively for Canada, it's a monster.
And what was their principal thrust in research when you were there?
Improve the efficiency of the present operations. Find byproducts from their current operations. Don't look at other things. Don't bother me with titanium, for example. I did a project, actually a PhD project, and I must say to their credit, partial credit, that they hired my student, a bright Greek. We had developed a method of producing titanium metal very cheaply using plasma technology. And Noranda had a good year, and the research center was being expanded. So I said, okay, we'll give it a try. So they hired Peter, he had his PhD by then, and they gave him $2 million for 2 years. Go ahead and develop that technology. And he made good progress until the 1991 budget was finally hammered out. It's a very painful process, incidentally. And titanium was not on the program. And Peter was asked to resign as of the end. And he had made a very sizable project to develop titanium aluminate, which commands a very high price. That was the first step in making titanium metal. He had developed that and patented it. And I said, we're not interested in going any further. I said, titanium is not a metal. The only metal that they allowed me to, exotic metal that they allowed me to develop, was molybdenum. And there, again, the plasma process, very cheap. And we decided to have the first plant built in near Ghent, Belgium, where we had good contact with the Saracen people. And then the stainless steel business collapsed. That's about 7 or 8 years ago. And it did collapse. And molybdenum, that main use was to strengthen high-strength, low-alloy steel, specialty steel standards and so on. So molybdenum was no longer in demand, in large demand. So they said, okay, we don't. The plant was only $40 million or something like that. For Lorena, that's nothing, you know. And, so that is the one deviation from the accepted path.
Well, the plasma technique, the plasma process as an engineering process, as a chemical engineering process, has a lot of applications, many of which you've developed.
No, not that I'm, developed, but it's developing slowly. It's a new technology, and the companies, even American companies, are reluctant. Well, they took an awful lot of my ideas. That's the eternal story. But I latched on with a company in England, Davy McKee, in Stockton-on-Tees, in the northeast of the UK. And I admired their guts. They bought our patents, against my patents, and I added as a counselor. And then when I worked for Hydro-Quebec, hands off. So we're in a very good contacts, and they're up to about 5 megawatts in Australia. But it is tough selling.
There's an article in, this is from Chemical Week in 1985, about the commercial promise of plasma processing. Your name is mentioned a few times.
Yeah.
And there seems to be some discrepancy, not discrepancy, but some disagreement as to how commercially promising this process really is.
Yeah. For certain things, it's excellent. For certain things, it's to make the cadmium and vanadium, for example, or zirconium, that's another terrific metal, zirconium metal, but not the zirconium that they use in our nuclear industry. Zirconium is very important for the CANDU, you see, but then it has to go through a very expensive purification process to remove the hafnium. Strangely enough, zirconium is always associated with hafnium, which is exactly twice the atomic weight. And you would say, geez, it's a cinch, eh, to separate zirconium from hafnium. Like hell, it's unbelievable. Their boiling point half a degree apart. Solubility is just sheer hell. So I say, well, why not use zirconium metal with hafnium for other purposes? I could make zirconium metal with hafnium for a couple of bucks a pound. It's a terrific metal, high temperature resistance and so on. Nobody much down.
Now, the peat processing, did you develop that? You had a number of papers on that.
Yeah, naturally.
Is that ever developed commercially into anything?
No, it is developed in Finland. They came to see the process and they're using it now. Yeah. Peat is a very good material. It's,
But not here?
No.
Why? Is there a reason for that? Is it just not economically feasible?
No, it's economic, but it's a gamble that people, the big people, are unwilling to take. It's tough to make a buck with that really advanced technology. We had a big program at Miranda on fiber optics. I staked a lot on this back in the 70s. I guess, saw a great future. And we really had, a bit of an advance. And then they said, it's ridiculous. The president said, here we have copper as a conductor, the best conductor in the world, and there you tell me that fiber optics will replace our copper? Are you nuts and all that? So I went out for a couple of years and it came down again. I've had my moments of despair, you know. Yeah. And we would have been leaders, but we needed millions of dollars. And once our first $5 million was expended, I went back for about 50. I said, let's put it. The answer was no.
The application of plasma techniques, the two, not just it yet, it's, well, there's so many different things, but disposal, waste disposal techniques, has that caught on?
Yeah.
Is that?
Partly, yes. Mainly in France. I was consulting a bit for EDF, Electricité de France. And I've developed several techniques, again based on my knowledge of AST, the atomized suspension techniques, spraying in presence of a plasma flame. And now I'm approached very strongly by companies right now, one in particular, Godfrey Aerospace. They would like to get a contract. They have been approached of a contract for the
Hibernia platform, and also, strangely enough, for frigates and destroyers and so on in Canada for the disposal of waste. In other words, human waste, largely, and all that. I refuse to do that. I know how to do it, and to hell with it. I don't want to have my friends, "Hey, Bill, you're very active again, eh? What are you doing?" I am treating SHIT. That's not very exciting. Neither, perhaps, but... I built one, mind you, for our little community in Beaconsfield. It was an impressive looking tower, about 25 feet high and big, in which we were handling the sanitary sludge. But we needed an engineer on duty, let's face it. It was, that technology cannot just go by. I was enthusiastic, and I told them that was sufficient. It's a good idea. Shudder. "Oh, yes, Bill Gova, yes. I remember your work in Beacons." I feel like disappearing through the floor.
What is the...
I don't know what the hell you can make of them all these stupid comments.
You'll see. How do you assess the state of education in chemical engineering in Canada today? I mean, do you attract students or getting people to go into the field, native Canadians?
Chemical engineering at McGill is in number four. Let's see, first, I'm sorry, I've got to count on my fingers. First is definitely electrical, mechanical, civil, chemical in fourth position. Our classes are one quarter of, for example, electrical. An average graduating class in chemical engineering is around 20 people. So it's no big shake. It's bigger at U of T. And yet our people are in great demand. But somehow we're not doing enough of a promotion job among young high school kids to take up that profession. And yet, once I get that degree, all my PhDs, I have one right now. He completed his work, splendid piece of work, plasma again, the recovery of chemicals and energy from Kraft black liquor. It's a monstrous problem. A good program. He completed his work 2 years ago, and then because of his energy and his will, I allowed him to take a job. Fascinating job. It took him 2 years. That was a mistake of my life. He finally completed his under duress. Everybody got, including the principal. David meeting me at the campus, "How about Stewart's thesis? Do you know that you're breaking all the rules?" And so on. So finally, he presented it last week. That's one thing, that's one error that we shouldn't make. It's an example of, here is a guy, he hasn't written his thesis, he's already offered a job. I've got requests from England for some of my boys. They all find jobs even before they completed their work, they're approached and so on.
Why would U of T have more students when your program's ranked higher? Your program is ranked higher than U of T's.
Oh, yes.
Yeah. They,
you're right.
They get more students.
Yeah.
Are most of your students from Quebec? Are they... Where do you draw students from?
That's a good... I should say that we have a lot of Asians, maybe 20%. We have a surprising number of girls, maybe 10%. We have very few Americans. I'm talking about undergraduate training, and the rest are Canadians, yeah. Quebec and Ontario and the rest.
So it's considerably localized then?
Yes, very.
What about at the graduate level?
Graduate level, Murray is doing a fantastic job. Murray and Douglas, I mean. And I'm no longer active. That's my last graduate student, I told him. I'm spinning my wheels on this, and it demands too much of my time. I'm trying to promote the university industry projects, and I have one going on in which I'm going to act as a technical director. It's one of my ideas to make silica, fumed silica, and that's going to be paid by a small company. They want to upgrade their production of silica, and it will be done at McGill. And yes, this is the sort of thing that I'm promoting. I definitely want to slow down.
Look, you said earlier that you had many turning points in your career. Turning points that weren't planned on your part, but events that sort of happened that were crucial events. Looking back on your career, what would you say was the high point of your...
High point?
Your... What gave you the greatest satisfaction? Let me ask, put it that way.
Yeah, I think reflecting back when I sold the our patents, and I got the money to Hydro-Québec, they promised me the moon, freedom of action, a beautiful lab at Varennes, on the outskirts of Montreal. But I have to respond to a Frenchman like me. That was a mistake. And he was afraid of me or not afraid, but he resented me. And then the director of research had a heart attack. Another guy walked in who had a different views of the importance of plasma. Although plasmas were a logical thing, the application of electricity for a company like Hydro-Québec, you see. And it didn't pan out. I still did a good job, but I didn't get the support I expected, and that's why I resigned, so frankly. But at that moment, I said, geez, I've got the world by the tail, because here I resigned, I left my job at Noranda on the 30th of March, my anniversary, and on the 31st, I walked into another job at Hydro-Québec, which held immense promises. Then I really felt on top of the world. I said, what a way to finish my career, you see. Didn't pan out. Yeah. The great kick I got was the Killam Prize. In Canada, of course, in the States, you have so many other things. And we're not talking about Nobel Prize, but in Canada, the Killam Prize in engineering, it was the first McGill guy who got it, and David Johnston, the principal, made a big thing of it, and he gave us a fabulous reception and so on, and I was a hero for one day, but I enjoyed the check.
Now, the Killam Prize is not just chemical engineering.
In engineering, no, they have three. They have a Killam Prize in medicine, a Killam Prize in literature, and a Killam Prize in engineering. Yeah. It's a very high honor in Canada.
What organization sponsors it?
Killam. Isaac Walton Killam. It was a very, very rich man, graduate of McGill University, and his widow has left a very large amount of, oh gosh, I don't know, about $100 million to McGill, but for fellows, for the prizes and so on. The amount is very large, but it's the interest on this, it's an endowment. Mm-hmm. Well, my dear fellow, I've kept you very busy. It's 12 o'clock.
Well, I've enjoyed it very much, and I appreciate your taking the time this morning to come over and talk to me.
Yeah, I talk too much.
No, completely.
I didn't know what to expect, so it's not the sort of things that you can prepare and make a crisp presentation.
I would prefer that it be spontaneous, actually, as a...
Well, it was spontaneous, I assure you. Yes.
Because it's meant to be a conversation. And it's been very, very interesting to me. Your career is quite different in many respects. You have an interesting blend of your long association with McGill and the academic,
and yet
a very, very strong industrial tie.
Oh, yeah.
Probably more than a lot of other chemical engineers in the sense that they may consult, but your association was a little more than just consulting. You were actually being employed.
Yeah, that's true.
While you maintained your doctoral thesis direction at McGill.
Yes.
That's a very interesting combination, and not very common one.
It's not, no?
I don't think so.
Well, not in Canada, I agree, but in the States, surely you must have examples of that.
But the academic tie is the major one, and the industrial tie is the consulting aspect.
Oh, yeah.
But consulting is not the same as what you were doing.
No.
You were the research director.
Yeah. Oh, yeah.
So your input was a lot different.
Yeah. But I must say, to explain this arrangement, which seems different to you, that chemical engineering is an engineering profession that lends itself beautifully for this, because chemical engineering, the way I was tackling, is processes, you see. Whereas others, electrical engineers, may specialize in computing and semiconductors and all this. Whereas processes have wider... that explains it, I think.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah. Yeah.
Well, thank you again.
You're most welcome.
I appreciate it.
I smoke like a chimney. That's probably...
I do, too, generally. So.
Yeah.